So there's a difference here between morals and obviously the law itself, right? Mm-hmm. But black letter law indicates that this can happen, as a result it happens. You want that to stop? Put pressure on Parliament. That's
change
it.
The law.
Change the law. Change people who are elected, change the law.
Right. Well, welcome to another episode of Gone Workabout, interesting stories from around the world. And today I'm joined with a good friend, Ben Musio. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. So you've guested on our Old Fox, Young Fox podcast a couple of times.
Yeah, so I'm still, I call myself a podcast virgin, really. But yeah, I've done a couple of episodes.
Yeah.
It's been quite an interesting experience, I think. I hate hearing myself, Will.
luckily, you don't have to do the edit. I do the edit.
Yeah, good, thank you. Which I'm hoping, like, you... Yeah.
I think my dad would tell me that that podcasting's probably taught me to speak less and listen more, which is quite a nice thing.
Mm.
So the idea is we just start off, I think, with a bit about you, where you come from and your journey through life.
Journey through life.
You've got a Scottish accent.
Yeah, I've got a Scottish accent. So let's start with that. I think journey through life is how long have you got? So I was born in Scotland in 1989. So I'm 30, going on 90. And I got an Italian father, and my mother is... She's English, but heritage is Caribbean. So her mum is from British Guyana, South America. It's a Caribbean nation, though. And my gran is born in St. Lucia. So, yeah, I've got a Scottish accent with an Italian passport, British passport, English mother who's also Caribbean. And I'm sure there's other things mixed in there as well, to be honest with you, from stories of my gran.
So tell us about your childhood. Where was that in Scotland?
Yeah, so I grew up in a place called Hamilton. So Hamilton is...
The original Hamilton, you might say. There's one south of Auckland.
Let's call it the original Hamilton, because I think there's one in... I'm pretty sure there's one in Canada as well.
I think there's two in Australia, because the founders obviously thought that no one would ever have the ability to drive across the continent and see two Hamiltons.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. It's actually, like, I'm quite happy with only just one Hamilton. But anyway, no. Hamilton is... how can I describe Hamilton? I don't go back that often. To Hamilton, but Hamilton itself is a town outside of Glasgow, a satellite town outside of Glasgow. It is your typical west of Scotland town, right? It's got its good and bits and kind of bad bits.
It's fallen on tough times, perhaps.
This is the thing for me to say that is it's true. It has, but I think generally there's a lot of areas that have fallen on tough times just generally.
Yeah.
But I would say that Hamilton, it's always had a relatively affluent, I would say affluent, and this is going to sound really bad, but, you know, for the area, affluent kind of community, then you would also have people who are not very affluent, or you would call them quite deprived in some respects as well. It's a bit of an eclectic mix of, not eclectic, but a mix of different types of people. However, growing up, it wasn't that diverse. I don't know what it's like now. I haven't gone back that often.
What do you mean by not that
so
diverse?
So diverse by, you know, me being Caribbean, Italian, so mixed race, in a family, we were pretty much amongst maybe one of, I can think counting about one hand, the amount of people of colour in, you know, the surrounding area.
And you're talking India, Asia...
I'm talking of people who would not be considered, if you were to, you know, who would not be considered as, you know, your white British.
Hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just the fact that, you know, we were a bit different to everyone else,
yeah,
basically, growing up.
The beginning of the migration of people into that part of the world.
I would definitely say so. And I wouldn't say we were the beginning. I'd say my mum came over in the 80s. Not really coming over in the 80s. She came up from England in the 80s, and she came from the northeast of England. And once again, they were, you know, my they had come from my gran, who had obviously come from my gran. Of course, it came from my gran. But my gran came over in the 50s, right?
And that group of people who came from the Caribbean to rebuild England. And
precisely.
Right.
So there's a bit of a story of migration in our life, really, with my dad coming over to the UK in the 80s, my mum moving to Scotland in the 80s. And then me actually moving down to England, actually. And it's not so much of a massive migration per se for me, but, you know, it's quite a lot of movement, you know, generally in our family history, is what I would say. But back to Hamilton itself. Hamilton is, to be honest with you, it was an interesting time for me growing up. There's some really good bits about it, and I met some really great people. There was some really shit bits about it as well. But I think if my story probably is very similar to a lot of other people in that respect. When they've left their hometown, they can look back and reflect what it's like.
Yeah.
And you see other things. You know, I'm in Brighton right now looking over your lovely, you know, view that you have, and, you know, it's very different to the view I had growing up and all that stuff, you know. So you can reflect.
Paint a picture for people of what the buildings were like.
So I would say, to be honest with you, and how can I put it? To be honest with you, it was very much satellite town. I wouldn't say grey, but, you know, grey is a theme, I would say, with the area of where we live. There was obviously new-ish built houses, 80s type housing, really. Architecturally, there's some really nice buildings in Hamilton. You know, we've got a really nice, one of the schools, Hamilton Grammar. It's a really, really lovely kind of stone, sandstone building. Beautiful. Actually, red
fun
sandstone.
Fact, do you know why they're called grammar schools?
Go for it.
I learned this from my intelligent girlfriend the other day. So they're called grammar schools because they used to be used for teaching the priests Latin grammar.
Really?
That's where it comes from.
Oh, cheers, mate. I didn't even know that.
There you go. So tell us about the Italian side then.
Okay.
So your dad, what part of Italy is he from? And
So my dad is from Lecce, which is in Puglia, right? So my dad grew up...
In the boot of Italy.
Exactly, the heel.
The heel.
The heel of Italy, correct. Yeah, the heel. And, Italy being a boot itself, boot-shaped. So he's from there, and his family are, you know, still there. So my aunties, uncles, cousins are all there. And once again, I haven't been back in a long time. They have come, some of my cousins have come over for my wedding and to see family and stuff like that. But we really need to do a trip out there at some point. So my dad, brother, and I have talked about going out with, you know, my wife and my dad's partner and whatever else, and just doing a nice trip. So I would love to see my family over there again. But the memories I have of going out there when I was younger were just absolutely wonderful. You know, food being absolutely amazing. Just general loving family, really cool. I think
it's quite Mediterranean down there, isn't it?
Hugely, hugely. I mean, you say Mediterranean, it's kind of atypical Mediterranean, you know. And I do remember days of just waking up and my auntie will be, you know, cooking like lunch or dinner already, and I wake up and I come out, and literally the day she will spend cooking. And then there'll be a feast in the evening. And I just, some of the food was just out of this world. And I've never been, I'm going to talk myself up here. I like to think of myself as a pretty good cook, right? You know, nobody's died yet since I'm cooking. Maybe that's a low bar. I don't know. But generally, I've never been able to replicate the flavours, or at least the kind of feeling of the food that I've had out there.
So maybe what were the couple of things that come to mind that she would often be making?
So there would always be, for some reason, I remember aubergines, but this lovely tasting, you know, very soft. And it's not like a melanzane, but more of a, I just can't describe it, but it was just wonderful. The other one is actually on aubergines being quite, not everyone's a fan of aubergines, but she makes them wonderfully. But the other things are things like, and this is very simple, it's very Italian to say this, but pasta, but homemade pasta with lovely hard, you know, medium hard, like
al dente.
No, but I mean the cheese itself.
Oh, right.
So it's lovely cheese, very, actually not even hard, but more, some of them cheese was lovely, but just the way it was mixed, the way it was, everything was fresh and wonderful. And it doesn't cost a lot either. And it's funny because when you go to, like, I'm going to say Waitrose, I'm going to show my...
I love Waitrose. I rebelled against it for the first few years.
Yeah,
I was like, that's a posh supermarket for posh people.
It's the establishment.
Exactly. I'm a boy from the bush. I walk around and everybody seems really posh and I feel out of my league. And it's kind of like going to a, I don't know, like to a library where you don't understand any of the books.
I agree, aye. Yeah. It's like, but for me, boy for Hamilton, the same thing. You know, you go into Waitrose and you're like, oh, shit.
This is where the others shop.
Yeah, yeah. This is
where. And now I walk around there and I'm like, these are my people, this is my food, right?
Exactly. I'm just like, oh, the olives, they're wonderful.
I mean, real olives, yeah, real olives.
These are great. They're nocciletta, nocciarella, or whatever they call them. That's yeah. Beautiful, yeah.
And the tomatoes say where they're from, and you've maybe been to some of those places. Oh, and you're like, nice. Yes, that's the tomato I want. So yeah, yeah. You're in safe company. It's okay to love Waitrose.
Yeah, stop judging me, people. But yeah, it's just, I don't know how we got into Waitrose, to honestly. How did we get into Waitrose? Yeah.
I always find my way to Waitrose.
Yeah, I think that's the point. But yeah, just general, back to the kind of Italian thing, the flavours, the, you know, the memories of that. And I absolutely, sorry. There we go. I've got an eyelash in me.
Well, there you go.
I can just edit that out.
I could, but I won't, because this is just a discussion. So
for everyone who's asking, I had a hair in my mouth. I have no idea where that's come from.
There's probably an Italian or Roman saying about that.
Yeah, probably. I'm glad me to mention it. But generally, so my dad is from south of Italy, and he has an Italian accent still, even though he came over in 87. I'm pretty sure he came over in 87, but he'll say Scottish words. So you'll speak, you know, use some Scottish slang. It just sounds very weird. Yeah.
Do you think he feels at home in Scotland?
Yeah. Yeah.
So he would consider himself Scottish.
There's a huge Italian community in Scotland. So we grew up. So the interesting thing was that we came from Hamilton, but to be honest, our cultural, if you want to call it cultural upbringing, is very different to a lot of my friends. So a lot of my friends who are from that area, pretty typical west of Scotland upbringing, nothing wrong with it, just general normal life. We would be, my brother and I, Lawrence and I, would be going to, you know, my dad was a chef for a good number of years, and he worked in a couple of hotels there, restaurants in Glasgow and whatever else. And we would go to the hotels that he worked at, and it would be full of Italian people. So we grew up in an Italian, very, very Italian, I wouldn't call it a household generally, but Italian community.
So when I say we're going to have fish and cheese, you think that's wrong? You don't put fish and cheese together?
Yeah, I don't know what you're doing there, but you know, you can. You do you. You just do you.
So the Italian in you would not. I understand.
Yeah, no, I suppose I'm all. To honestly, I'm not. I would never. I would always just try new things. You know,
Yeah. But you understand the fundamentals.
Cheese sauce.
Yeah.
Yeah, you do that.
Yeah.
I suppose it could work, and especially if you do like a pasta with cheese and put some cheese, you know, some fish through it. You could try it. Yeah. Anyway.
Meat on top of risotto.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's quite an authentic Italian cuisine sort of upbringing you had. Okay.
Great. I would say that, but I'd also say generally, like, so we would, you know, upbringing wise, so one thing that we haven't got is the ability to speak the language. And the reason being is that, unfortunately, you know, mum and dad sort of separated when we were, you know, preteen, you know, 11, around, I was about 11 years old. But we never really grew up speaking the language. My mum spoke, and she lived out in Italy, and I actually lived out in Italy when I was a baby. Don't remember any of it, obviously, I was too young, but we spent about a year and a bit, maybe a couple of years out in Italy. So I lived in Lecce for a bit. But we never really learned the language, and it's one of the regrets my dad has, but I have as well, that I never really was enthusiastic about learning. But
however, which is interesting, because you've basically not stopped learning since then, right?
Correct.
Avid reader. Da, da, da.
I like to think of myself as a relatively avid reader. Shan, my wife, will probably say no. I've got books in the house I've probably not picked up in ages. But
you have a wall of guilt.
Yeah, I've got a wall of guilt. That's it. It's exactly it. But then it also makes me look smart, so it's good. No, but I'm actually quite into my podcasts, listening to them, but also very into my audiobooks, because my job is I commute quite a lot, so it's nice to read something, to listen to something. And but I do like the ability to have something physical in my hands. The only problem is that I just get a bit frustrated when I'm on the train. I'd rather just have yes. zone out, you know, and just listen.
So what are the first couple of books that come to mind, things you would recommend to others?
Oh, right. So a book I read a while ago, and I resisted reading for a long time, and I don't know why, but I think it was just because of the film itself. It was American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis. Probably the best book I've ever read. Don't know why it is, and I've read, I'm not some scholar here, but I've read, quite a few books, right?
Mm.
Best book I've ever read. And why? Because of the descriptions, it was very vivid, and I was just immersed in it.
Mm.
Like, I was reading about Patrick Bateman and being like, bloody hell, I had a picture of him in my head. I had a really interesting kind of insight to his thought process, which was weird. But just general, the whole kind of loads of money culture in the '80s, the 80s and 90s, whatever, but the whole kind of, I don't know, just everything about it, the bizarre thought processes, I would say even just the kind of excessive wealth as well as poverty, and the kind of cheat, what I'd call the contrast between the two. And it was done pretty well. I would say that's probably something that it could have been a bit better, to honestly, the descriptions of poverty and wealth. But there's a lot of extravagance in the film and the book, and it was just something that I was able to gobble it up. It was weird. I was just able to go next book, next page, and I read it in Alaska. So I started reading it in Alaska, so I read it on the plane over, and then, read it bits here and there when I was on holiday, and then came back and I put it down for a bit and then went back into it, and it was just because of life, just general,
And I
knew I had to go back to it, and I knew I had to finish it, because I'm one of those people that will start reading something and then go on to something else and be like, it doesn't capture me. This, on the other hand, I couldn't read anything else until I finished it. Awesome. Didn't take me that long, but brilliant book. I would say, though, if you're going to read it on your commute, be careful, because some of the stuff in there is pretty descriptive, and if somebody's looking over your shoulder and reading some of it, they're going to think you're a psycho. So yeah,
fair enough.
Yeah,
all right, anything else that comes to mind,
books wise I'm going to try to think. J.G. Ballard, Millennium People, about a kind of middle class uprising, bit basic I would say, but it was a good book for me. And then actually, everyone's going to be like, of course, but Orwell for me, George Orwell, and Road to Wigan Pier, great book, just description of the North, it was just brilliant. Another one for me, sorry to say it to everyone, but Animal Farm in 1984, brilliant books, like for me, brilliant books anyway, but that maybe speaks to my own personality.
It shaped a lot of cinema.
Exactly.
A lot of sci-fi, a lot of future-focused.
Correct. Works. Exactly. And towards you, and it's funny because I do get annoyed sometimes when people, I read The Guardian, right, but you'll see people talking about, you'll use quotes.
So just explain The Guardian to the
Guardian, people who don't know, is, it's a, I would say a left-leaning, quite liberal paper in the UK.
One of the only, perhaps.
I would say so, yeah. I would definitely. But I don't know, it's just annoying me. Sometimes you'll see people quoting Orwell or quoting, because of maybe they think they're living in some sort of dystopian nightmare at the moment. It's not quite that, is it, really? It's bad, but it's not that bad. But it just makes me cringe sometimes. So this is why I'm saying sorry to people about, talking about 1984, because it seems to be the go-to for a lot of people.
And let's talk about a couple of audiobooks.
Audiobooks. So let me get...
Or podcasts.
So I'll get my phone out for the people who are listening. So currently, right now, I am listening to Brexit Cast, Election Cast. So people who want to know about that, Election Cast or Brexit Cast is simply some political editors for BBC talking about all things Brexit and just really the developments. And they're at the heart of it. They're in the heart of Westminster. They're in Brussels. And really just talking about the insight that they're having. And it's pretty cool, because you've got your standard news and it's pretty formulaic, but the way that they talk, they're getting text messages, they're listening to, they know these politicians in a much deeper level.
So where are we at with the whole Brexit thing as you're hearing it?
Right, so where we're at at the moment is we are currently, so we've obviously we're still not left the European Union. The vote took place in 2016, 2017, can't remember, but it's maybe 3 years or whatever that we've been waiting, well, people have been waiting to leave the EU. I am a Remainer, obviously. I would say, obviously, given the Italian father, you know.
sure.
Italian passport.
And as a migrant who likes the way that Europe works, I'm also a Remainer, so I get that.
Yeah, I like the freedom of movement for me. I like that, right?
But,
you know, whatever. Some people don't have that same opinion. It's not just that. But generally, where we're at the moment is people can't agree what type of Brexit we want. And at the moment, the biggest divide is pure, not divide, but the biggest frustration for a lot of people is the fact that in Parliament there is no real majority for any type of Brexit. Even though people want Brexit, they can't agree what they want. The other issue is the fact that the political parties, there's no majority, right? So as a result of that, you're not really going to be able to push things through in a minority government. So currently, at the moment, Conservatives are the leading, are the, what you would call, the biggest party, but because they are smaller than the rest of the opposition, then they're not able to push a lot through. And there's also Remainers in the Conservative Party and Brexiteers, and there's enough factions. But then also in Labour as well, you've got some Brexiteers, or at least people who are voting for the in favour of the of a referendum purely because of the fact that they are in Remain seats, and maybe they believe in Brexit itself.
And we have an election coming up.
Correct. So we have an election on the 4th of... is it the 11th or 4th?
I think it might be closer to the 11th, but I
think it's the 11th, yeah, by the 12th, I'm pretty... Or the 3rd, no, 12th, sorry. The election day, I think, is the 12th of December.
Hmm.
It's a national election across the UK, and really that will probably return another hung parliament, in my opinion, with no majority party. And as a result of that, there's either going to be a backdoor deal done or another supply and confidence vote for either Conservatives or potentially Labour. But at the moment...
And what will that mean?
The same.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
So we might see another 3 years. What is the term in England at the moment? Is it
5 years?
5 years.
5 years.
Cameron changed it, right?
Yeah, so it's a Parliament Act. I think it's 2010, I'm pretty sure.
So we might see another 5 years of nothing happening.
Not 2010, talking rubbish. But we could have an... I don't think so. I know that Brexit... To be honest, in my opinion, Brexit will happen just because of the fact that there seems to now be an appetite for making sure that people get, you know, they respect the vote. But at the same time, there is an argument to be made about having a second referendum. But once again, there's a lot of discussions about whether that would be democratic or not.
Mm.
In my opinion, I think it is democratic. It's the most democratic thing you can do, which is to have a vote, right? Putting it to the people as democracy.
Yeah, particularly now that people have 3 years of thinking about it.
Correct. So it's like the argument people use is, you know, if you buy a house, you go, you get it checked out, you don't sign the dotted line straight away, you do all your tests, you do your checks, you make sure that the structure is correct. You kick your tires, you don't kick your tires in a house. Anyway, it depends on what type of house.
You kick the foundations.
But you kick the foundations and you consider what's going on, really. But the point is that, you know, for me, it's all about... People should be more informed now about what's
and more saying. Involved, right?
Very much so. And on either side,
I believe there's 9 million people in the UK that are not registered to vote.
Hmm.
So if you're listening to this and you're not registered to vote, what would you say to those people?
Get your arse in gear and vote whoever you want to vote for.
Yeah, and just get involved, right?
I think generally, the problem is I can see why people maybe don't register to vote because they just feel very much disenfranchised by the whole thing, right?
Mm.
In my opinion, sorry, go for it.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that I think one of the positives that's come out of this turmoil that Brexit has created is that people are being forced to question the red and blue.
I agree, yeah.
And the red and blue ultimately hasn't really led us down a very good path as an economy. It hasn't in New Zealand, it hasn't in Australia, I don't think it has in Canada, I don't think it has in the States, certainly hasn't in England. I'm measuring it on the key metrics.
Yeah, I get it.
Apart from infant mortality, which is good, but that could be just science.
Mm.
If you look at all of the gross happiness product measurements, try saying that fast, it's declining. You look at depression, it's increasing. Perhaps this might be the first generation that lives less years than grandma did.
Yeah.
There's things happening that polarization between rich and poor, number of unemployed, and I mean real number of unemployed.
Yeah.
So I'm including those that have one day a week of work.
I agree.
That's not enough.
Yeah.
So looking at all those metrics, I feel like the red, blue, right, writer, right, writer kind of process that we've gone down.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that hypothesis has been tested and now it's time to question it.
Do you think...
I would like to see red and blue shrink, and I would like to see split off parties that reflect more accurately the spectrum of views in a society.
Do you think there is a clear divide between... No, I don't mean clear divide, but do you think you could really... I think there's factions within factions nowadays. So you've got right, left, and left. And then you've got maybe some people in the middle as well who are maybe you would say socially liberal, but economically you would say maybe more conservative.
Maybe they're environmentalists, but perhaps they're socially liberal.
Yeah. Exactly. So you've got people who potentially would say, look, I like the way in which the Tories have got maybe a low taxation, if you want to call it that. And that's just a general example. But I also want to ensure that there is, a Green New Deal or something. I want to make sure that, emissions are lower. I don't think these are now left and right issues. I think Brexit for me is not. And so I'm kind of stealing this from what I heard on Brexitcast itself, but I do agree with it. The things like Brexit are not really left and right issues anymore.
And I think that's a step forward for democracy.
Do you think so?
I do, because I think that we need to become more issue-based rather than tribal.
I understand. No, I get that. And it's more about thinking about the facts, but I think...
I'm not just a Labour guy or a Conservative guy. I am thinking about the environment.
What the issues are.
And I'm thinking about plastic bags, and I'd like women to earn the same amount as men.
Yeah, agree.
And I'd like us to have that kind of policy on migration and refugees. That, to me, is bigger than just a party.
And do you think, and I think just generally you think to yourself, well, what would you say these are all left-wing policies or are these all right-wing policies? Towards you, I think issues-based politics is maybe potentially a way forward. It's not, and for me, I would consider myself on the left of the spectrum, but what that actually means, I don't know anymore. And so as a result, I don't mean it as if I don't know anymore, because I just generally feel much... I think at uni I would have defined myself as a definite socialist, right? Nowadays, do I see myself as a socialist? Well, I do like things like the NHS. Is that really socialist ideology? Yeah, it is in some respect, because it's obviously government, state run.
It's the health service.
It's the health service, right?
But look at the States where they have a lot less of that.
It's ridiculous.
And that's not the way you would want us to go, right?
Yeah, a bit like...
I get it.
I think my point is really... what is my point? I don't think there really is one, other than the fact that when you say things like socialism to someone...
It's very loaded, isn't it?
They think it's a bad word, right?
Yeah.
It's like, socialism. God, you're one of them, are you? And it's one of those things where, oh, I don't know. Like, do you like your NHS? Yeah, of course I like that. Do you think that the trains should be privately run and, money should be going straight to... for people in the UK who are not in the UK, maybe listening to this, the trains in this country, and this is a massive issue for me because I spend a lot of my time commuting on them, the trains are privately run, but the National Rail maintains the tracks, right? But you have franchises on each of these rail systems. So the Brighton Line, where we commute on, or people commute on, there's about three different franchises on that line.
Thameslink, right? Southern Rail.
And Gatwick Express.
Yes, that's
right. So you've got three of those. Each of them, you've got different prices. I pay a stupid amount of money. So I was, being...
And you're commuting into the city from a satellite town.
Correct.
Towards Brighton.
Yeah. So I'm not, I'm just outside Brighton.
Yeah.
And I'm going into London every day. And so I commute every day pretty much. I work from home sometimes as well. But I'll pay a stupid amount of money per month. And I've got a season ticket, which I paid a chunk off of, and I've got a season ticket loan for my work. But the amount I pay per month, I said to my mum in Scotland, she's like, how much? And that was the cheapest one, right? I got the cheapest one, so I can only go on one train, one type of train, at one franchise. But I get zones 1 to 6 of London, so I can go in and out of London, as I please.
And so what sort of money are we talking per year in the range?
In the range between £4,000 and £5,000 a year.
Right.
Okay. And if I want,
so that's up to 10,000 Australian dollars, just to translate it for the southerners.
Yeah, and so
it's an enormous amount of money.
Correct, and I, 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 I've done some work in the Netherlands recently, so I've travelled out there and was talking to a couple of people out there, and it's really cool. And I love the Netherlands. I was in Amsterdam specifically, but it was a really, really cool place. I was asking, the guy who was taking me to the office, who's the taxi driver, and he said to me, I said, how much are your trains? And he said, just out of interest, because they're always on, maybe this is a misconception, but every time I've been there, they've been on time, right? And they've got me A to B, no problem, been an issue, no delay. But maybe, that's just my own perception.
I've had the same experience in Spain, France, Germany.
It seems to run really well.
Yeah.
The guy said to me, I think the most you would ever pay per month for a full kind of range of public transport completely, if you wanted everything, would be €250. Or whatever, right? And I think that's like a maximum. And my train from like Schiphol Airport, for instance, to from Schiphol to Amsterdam Central, it's about €4.50.
Yeah,
€4.50 translate to probably £4.50 nowadays. To be honest with you,
yeah.
But £4 or whatever, right?
And it would be like £12 in England, right?
More than that. It's just ridiculous. It could be a little bit less than that. I don't think so. It's ridiculous. And you're going to be, and the train isn't guaranteed to be run on time.
And the point is that the benefits of privatisation, we are told, according to the right-wing textbook from the 60s, that would lead to efficiency, a better service, better trains.
More competition, therefore, means it's a better service, which actually means, for me, on a 3-franchise, 1-line, suggests there's actually congestion. There's no agreement. I don't know. There just seem to be issues with timetables. And actually, a lot of money being paid for not great service. Yeah.
The trains are terrible. Loads of people are delayed, right?
Exactly. There's days where, and I get in quite early. And the reason I go into work really early is because, one, I don't want to fight a battle before I have to go into work. And I'm not saying I have to fight a battle in work, but days are like sometimes. You have to...
So what time are we talking?
I'm in the office I'm usually in the office for about 5 past 8, 8:15.
Yeah.
Every day.
So that means you're getting a train.
I'm getting six, depends, like 6:50, 6:30, between, depending on what.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's quite an early train.
It's an early train. Yeah,
I mean, the Australians and the Kiwis and the Americans that are listening are going to say everybody commutes, what's the big deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think the difference is that in Europe, there's less commuting going on.
Yeah.
Do you feel that?
I think there is a bit of commuting. I think the only thing is that London is such a hub.
Yeah.
That you do need to, because the jobs are there. There's a lot of jobs there. So as a result of that, you make do. And my brother, who works for a big organisation, indicated that to me, that there's somebody who travels from Wales into London.
Yeah.
So I know people who travel from places like Portsmouth, people who travel from...
So we're talking hours, right?
We're talking like 2 hours, 2 hour commutes.
Yeah.
And 2 hour and a half, 2 hour commute, just on the train itself. Then you have to get into London itself.
Yeah, so...
And, it's not cheap.
Hmm.
And so that's... So when we're talking about things like nationalisation, we're kind of digressing slightly, but it's quite cool. We're just kind of shooting the breeze here.
Part of the fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So has privatisation worked in your mind?
At least in this example, right, in this example of the train service that I have experienced, I'm very, very qualifying here, no.
Yeah.
Right?
Because so what do you think we could do about that?
In my opinion, I think you take away, make it a not-for-profit service, pump the money back into, one, make sure people are paid well. All right, okay. And this is the ideal world, right? Make sure people are paid well, but have a great service. Can't you have that? Why would you want to have have your cake and eat it? Well, in my opinion, I'd say, why would I make a cake if I didn't want to eat it, right?
Mm.
Yeah, quite simple. So I think to myself...
You look at Portugal, you look at Spain, places that have a lot less money in the local economy.
I agree.
And I know that the EU has funded some of the laydown of the tracks initially, but their services,
fantastic.
My God, it's amazing. You go into Lisbon and to Lisbon and it feels like you've gone ahead in time 20 years.
Yeah, we go to Paris, for instance. Last time I was in Paris not long ago and, train's fine, perfect. Get on, I get on the metro, fine.
Yeah, and France is not as wealthy as England.
It's not. It's relatively wealthy, though. It's,
sure.
It is an economic power, I would say.
Sure.
But you're right. And I would say where we live, for people once again on the podcast, we live in the southeast, which is, I would say, probably the most affluent area.
Agreed.
The southeast, southwest, and the most affluent area of the UK.
Yeah, because we're commutable to London, and London is the hub, and it's not just a hub for the world, it's the hub for England, right?
Well, most definitely, but for the UK, I would say it's a big hub.
Now, you work in professional services, right?
So I work in tax. Yeah. I work for a big four.
Yeah.
Accountancy firm.
So what does that mean? What does working in tax for a big four mean?
Bloody hell. Good question. What does it mean?
Who is your customer? Is your customer a small business, a large business?
They're financial services. Financial services, your big banks.
Okay.
The clients that we have are big banks, asset managers, private equity.
And each year they have to do returns each quarter sometimes. Is
what
that
I do
about?
Is not that, no. It's more around reporting obligations around the world, basically. So things like the automatic exchange of information. For those tax geeks out there, you'll know what that is.
Can you explain it to the rest of us?
Essentially what it is in the briefest possible way, is to say that like the OECD the United States IRS kind of implemented these kind of global reporting statuses for financial services industry, for financial services, where they have to essentially identify people who could potentially be paying taxes in the States or in other jurisdictions. So
let's say Apple.
Not quite, no. So let's say if you pick a big...
Oh, you mean financial services
businesses. If you pick a big bank, they would have to report...
So say Lloyds, because they're one of the biggest.
Any bank, yeah. Yep. Any bank, anybody, you know, big international base. You could potentially have US taxpayers, for instance, and US taxpayers, the US want to know if you've got US account holders, are they paying tax in the US or not? So you've got to ensure you report the type of people... To ensure that the tax authorities are aware of who's actually, with migration and all that kind of stuff, who's where and who's paying what. Right?
Sounds like a good thing in terms of making sure tax is paid.
In my opinion, yeah. The other thing that I do I'm very, very much, my area of speciality at the moment within my job is a thing called DAC 6, which is a European directive, which forces... And it's not just financial services, it's just generally, in individuals, lawyers, tax advisors, big organisations who have basically what you would call multi-jurisdictional transactions. So from country A to country B, right, it's got to be a European country. So cross-border arrangements that hit one of the hallmarks within the directive. So they're has to be reported to the tax authorities, right? And the reason being is that the EU, the OECD had actually come up with this idea, and the mandatory disclosure rules, and then the European Union kind of established it itself and made it a directive across all 28 EU member states, is to ensure the erosion of tax bases doesn't happen. So what that means is essentially you could have quite smart tax arrangements where you maybe shift profits from one jurisdiction to another, or
that's known as transfer pricing, is that right?
Yeah, well,
there's a number of different definitions.
Yeah. And towards my area of transfer pricing is definitely not my area of speciality, but at the same time, things where you maybe get a tax advantage by doing a cross border transaction where you may be paying less tax as a result of it, or you've moved things around, you're investing in securities. And lending those securities to someone else, all that kind of stuff. And essentially what will happen is that it could potentially be reportable under the directive. And it's ensured tax authorities ensuring that they'll have the data to understand what big organisations are doing to ensure that there's no funny business from a tax perspective.
And this is quite a big thing for me, because something I've been thinking about is the move to Amazon, right? And that's partly because I'm about to go on a big trip, and so Amazon's been my friend, right? Because I'm buying socks and backpacks and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But something that occurs to me, and something that is quite big in fintech at the moment, yep, is what happens when you sell me some socks from France to England to make sure that the right tax is being paid,
yeah,
on your invoice to me for these £12 socks or whatever they might be. Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, there's a movement in the EU, isn't there, to make the marketplace like Amazon or eBay responsible for the sellers paying tax correctly in each jurisdiction.
I think the whole point generally is to there's a move.
I'm just going to turn the heater up.
No worries, yeah.
Because it's winter.
Nice and wet outside.
Sorry, back to you.
No, there's a move essentially to ensure that people, individuals, and corporations are paying the correct tax, or they're not being able to take advantage of grey areas in law.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everyone says,
which is a noble business,
which,
right?
I think so. And so my speciality at the moment has been really looking at the directive, understanding the directive, and really amongst a number of people where I work, and really ensuring that I can advise our clients basically on what the impact will be on their business and how they can comply with
this. So this has been a change. It has been a tightening, would you say?
Yeah. So what I actually do is actually helping organisations. One of the big things that people I work with do is actually helping organisations ensure that they comply with
the new legislation.
New legislation, and actually ensure that they understand it, because there's huge penalties involved.
So can we, just to put this in perspective for people that don't work in that space.
Boring. So, I mean, most of them probably fall asleep. You probably lose some listeners listening to me about this.
No, it's interesting, right? Because what it comes down to ultimately is when we look at what a government has, say the UK government, in terms of tax revenue to spend on things like the NHS or the rail system or whatever it might be, or schools, which are massively underfunded and in a declining spiral, with drastic consequences in terms of England's declining levels of literacy and everything, right?
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
So based on that, would you say that just for people on the street, that the government is likely to be getting more money from Joe and James Smith or more money from corporations? Like, how does this actually balance?
To be honest with you, in my opinion, right, and bearing in mind that
is corporation tax a big deal for a government, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm not an economist, but I would say that it is. Yeah, the corporation tax rate at the moment is quite low. It's around about 17%.
Much lower than a lot of tax.
It was 20. Rates. No, exactly. But at the same time, really, in my opinion, the biggest. So a lot of people are angry, right, at what I would say is organisations or whatever for not paying their taxes, right? Or perceived to have not paid their tax. And some of them have paid their tax, others haven't, right? It's just, you know, the way I see it is this. Governments should legislate to ensure that this doesn't happen, right?
Agreed.
That's it. Legal text if the law allows you to do X, Y, or Z to ensure, and it's not more, it's not about, look, I'm just going to, the law says this, I'm going to do this, right? Let's take individuals as an example.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe you'll hear many people talking about, and this is going to sound really bad, so I'm not defending anyone here, but what I'm saying
is just explaining it.
Yeah, I'm trying to explain. There'll be situations where you have individuals who are maybe self-employed, right, who will say, well, how can I pay less tax?
Sure.
You don't hear about that in the news. You genuinely don't hear about that in the news. You don't hear about people saying, well, I want a tax refund, or I want to make sure that this happens, or how can I ensure that I don't pay the right level of tax, and maybe I can pay dividends instead to myself rather than paying, you know, via PAYE system, or, you know, declaring myself as self-employed, so I'm having to pay the normal levels of taxation in this country.
Hmm.
Well, in my opinion, you're perfectly entitled to do so because the law legislates for you that. I'm not saying it's right, so there's a difference here between morals and obviously the law itself, right? Mm-hmm. But black letter law indicates that this can happen. As a result, it happens. You want that to stop? Put pressure on Parliament. That's
change
it.
The law.
Change the law. Change the people who are elected. Change the law.
Mm.
Now, then there's obviously an argument to say, well, look, we need to think of competition. We need to think of things like, attractiveness of the economy. We want to ensure that there are big employers here. We want to make sure that there are wealthy people in the country. Yes.
And there's a problem at the moment for England, isn't there, that with Brexit looming and London being a hub for corporations and for financial services, but also tech, there's other economies nearby like Ireland with Dublin, who are saying, just come and base your head office here, Google or Microsoft or Apple or whoever it might be. And so there is a competition between countries.
I think there's a massive competition amongst countries. And I think really for me, the way in which you stop anything that is the funny business that you're talking about, right, which actually doesn't happen that often anymore. The other interesting thing, the one thing that I suppose annoys people, maybe not like myself because I'm not that smart, but people who are smarter than me in the industry that I'm in, actually turn around and say, the stuff that people are talking about that maybe would have been considered as the real tax avoidance stuff and all that stuff doesn't happen anymore. The law doesn't allow it to happen.
So in the last 30 years or so,
it's changed.
It's okay. Changed. Because that's a good thing.
Because of technology, because of awareness of tax authorities, and the amount of data that they actually now look at, all that's changing. So you don't have this kind of, nobody's in back rooms anymore planning the next scheme. Sometimes it happens and you get anomalies, but they get caught out very quickly and as a result they change.
And movies are made.
Yeah, exactly. But most of it's pretty vanilla. And I'm not talking about client, I'm just very want to qualify here. It's not talking about clients that we have or I have or anything else. It's nothing to do with that. It's just general looking at the landscape of taxation.
Sure. Right? And another example, which is perhaps a little bit less close to what you would do every day, but I think more relevant to people listening, is that England has this process of landlord and tenancy law and purchasing law. Yeah, yeah. And we've had a stamp duty been introduced, haven't we? So anybody that wants to go and buy a second property has to pay tax for that. And the reason for that is to prevent people who have 15 properties from depriving you from buying your first. Right?
Yeah, it's that. Well,
that was kind of the idea.
Yeah, it's also about just making sure that if you've got property invested, you've got other properties, then you should probably pay some tax on that. If you're wealthy enough to be able to do this, then you should be paying tax. But tax,
which I think is a good thing.
Yeah, tax isn't a bad thing, right? The one thing that is the problem, sorry I'm over talking here, but the one thing I would say is that the way in which tax money and revenues is used is the issue.
So let's move on to that.
Because I think that's, and I'm not an expert in that area.
Me neither.
Right?
But we all have opinions.
Exactly. Unqualified, maybe, but definitely have opinions. I would say that it's interesting to see the level of poverty that we have in this country, given the fact that we have a lot of wealth in this country.
That's going to surprise all the people that don't live in the UK.
I mean, it's huge.
Because when I was first preparing to come here, I spoke to a guy called Matt in my office, who is a Londoner. And we were in Melbourne, and London felt far, far away.
Mm.
Right? Mm. It felt like the cold, dark place that no one goes to unless they really want to get that good job. And so then I said to him, so I'm going to England. What can I expect? And he said, you're going to see less jet skis, one less garage, people with less money to throw around, but they'll have a smaller mortgage and they'll probably walk or train to work compared to people in the Antipodes who are commuting a lot further and spending a lot more time in their car. I said, what about society? And he said, you're going to see rich like you've never seen, and you're going to see poor like you've never seen. And I kind of just laughed it off. But then I got here and I was driving down the motorway up north, and people were flashing their lights behind me. And I was going 10% over the limit, which is as far as I could get before the law would give me a ticket.
Yeah,
And what was interesting to me is that the cars that were flashing their lights behind me were going fast enough that they would get extremely high amounts of ticket, but they didn't care. And they'd fly past in cars that I'd never even seen, E-class Mercs that we don't even have in Australia.
Really?
So we're talking levels of wealth. We'd drive down the road and we were looking for an Airbnb, maybe in the countryside. And there's this enormous driveways down to these manor houses in the distance. And I'm like, wow, that house is older than the white man being in New Zealand, right? Like, you know, it's older than 150, 160 years or whatever it might be. And then people that we would stay with would say, oh, that's the fifth richest family in England. And, you know, Tony Blair and other politicians are going there for a meal tonight, you know. And I'd just never seen that before. On the other side, I'd never seen this level of poverty.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And it's a thing.
Poverty is real. And, you know, it's funny because, like, there's poverty and there's poverty and then there's poverty. And that sounds really strange. Those two are the same words. I think it's relative. Poverty in some respects is relative. And I think in the UK, for instance, where you have and I would say we've been talking about the infrastructure in terms of commuting and stuff, but it ain't that bad, right?
Okay, there's you can still get to work and there's still work.
There's still work. There's running water. There's this, there's that. And yet there's people who just don't have access to that stuff sometimes. They don't have the money. So like on my train, when I commute, like I'm coming back from London, it's usually a lot of panhandling. It's not a phenomenon really. It's been going since time, you know, immemorial, I suppose. But recently it's been a lot more and I've noticed it a lot more.
What was the phrase you used?
Panhandling. I think it's that's right. I think
it is right, but it's right. But it's something I hadn't heard until I got to England.
Yeah, so it's the people coming on, and it's usually homeless people who are looking for money on the trains. I think it's called panhandling.
It is called that.
Yeah, is it? All right, yeah. And you're not allowed to do it apparently. But what
you're not allowed to do it.
Well, apparently not. You're not allowed to. I don't know. I was talking to my brother who was mentioning it. Maybe it's right.
I saw it on the tube the other day and I was like, that's interesting. I haven't seen that for a while.
Happened in the tube to me 2 days ago. Mm. And I haven't seen it on the tube until now.
So what does that tell you?
In my opinion, people are getting more desperate, right? Because it takes a lot to stand up in front of a train, maybe of a full of people, busy, and just say, hi, everyone. You know, my name is X or whatever. And I've fallen on tough times, blah, blah, blah. And it's one of those things where you're just like... And it's weird because I never have change on me, right? I don't carry change. Like, I just never have change on me. It's just because it's the way that we live nowadays. I can literally pay everything with my phone if I need to, right? So I never have change on me.
So you're genuinely accurate when you say, sorry, man, I don't have any change.
Yeah, when I say, like, I'm really sorry, I'll look... You know, you look at me, I'm like, I'm sorry. And they'll probably think, are you...
Tight.
You're a tight arsehole, or you're just not giving me the money, blah, 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 blah. And sometimes I'm like, look, I genuinely love to help, but I don't have the money. And in other occasions, you're just like, fucking hell. What? And this is going to sound really bad, but what level of desperation does it make to take for somebody? You just need to have to do that.
Yeah, how did they get there, right?
And it could be a number of factors, right? You have to play not devil's advocate, but there's always more than one side to a story, right? Even more than two sides sometimes, right? It could be drugs, it could be alcohol, it could be hard times, it could be a number of things. And it's not just that. And it doesn't mean because you've got a drug problem, therefore you shouldn't get help. It's more there are circumstances where people just haven't been able to have either not sought the help, maybe are aware of it, because there is a lot of help out there who've not got it. But at the same time, more should be done, right? Yeah. I think...
And there's an interesting situation in Brighton, and I'll get a friend on to talk about this specifically in a later episode. Mm. But that, as I understand it, from folks who are saying, you know, I want to go to a soup kitchen or a food van. I want to do my bit. And they would say, oh, you're right, got long legs, kicking me under the table there.
Playing footsie, guys.
There's a lot of affection on this podcast. So, you know, they would say, are there enough beds for everybody on the street? And they'd say, yeah, there is. There is enough beds on the street.
Yeah.
But there's reasons that people don't use those beds, like abuse, drugs, trying to stay away from abuse and drugs that might, in these places that they could sleep for free, that someone might pick on them, for example.
Yeah.
And all of their things are in a shopping cart and they can't take that shopping cart in. There's nowhere to put that when they go to sleep at night. Yeah. So they don't want to lose everything they have in the world in order to sleep under a roof. And then some people actually don't want to be in that space. They want to get their own way to getting off the street. So I take your point. There is more to it.
There's more to it, but
you're right. But something does need to be done.
Something needs to be done.
And it's a worrying sight.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like kind of weird when you're sat on the train and somebody is talking and they are... You've just got a train full of people. And you don't... Look, I'm going to be honest. Just because you're on a train doesn't mean that you're wealthy either.
No.
Right?
It means you're going to work.
I don't know what the person next to me either. Come from work, could have been at a job interview, may not have to work, may be really struggling for that. I just don't know, right?
Mm.
Point is, though, it's a really strange situation where you're sat and this voice, everyone's talking, this person's talking, and everyone's just looking down. Nobody's looking at that person. They're just...
looking away.
Yeah. It's like... It's really weird.
It doesn't feel good, does it?
You know, it really doesn't. But I think a lot of people feel bad about it.
Mm.
And I think generally, if you're a human, you would feel bad about it. And I just, you know, when we're talking about poverty and wealth in this country, there is that. There is a lot of that. And you're right, completely. I think, like, growing up back to, like, Hamilton, for instance, like, you know, we witnessed, and, like, my brother, we didn't grow up wealthy either. You know, we grew up definitely working class family, you know, and you know, we had a few struggles in our time as well, you know, loving family, but you know, that is what it is. But we never had that level of issue ever. You know, we were very lucky. But
you had good nutrition, you had a roof over your head,
we had a roof over our head.
And you went to school.
I went to school, you know what I mean? And, you know, that, the, it, you know, if you want to call it basic, right, that's what we had in that respect. And we had, like, nice, we had good times in our life, but then some really tough times as well. But we never had that level of issue.
And, you know, I hear this a lot from people who go to the States, and I've seen it myself, right? You go to New York and you're like, I thought everyone was going to be rich there. I thought it was the what I saw on TV, right? I didn't realize that they clean the streets before they shoot anything in New York, and that actually a big city has very rich and very poor.
That is what it
is. And you know, it would probably surprise a lot of people to know that the country that was at the center of the empire, that drew resources from all other places in the empire, from places that both you and I have come from, that not everybody in that country is doing well.
No, exactly. You and I just have to take a walk out of your flat, right? Walk out. And 2 seconds down the road and you've got, you know, we're living a lovely place and you've got a lovely view of the sea and all that stuff and it's gorgeous, right? But you walk out, you go down the street, there'll be somebody with a sleeping bag. So I was at the gym. I just came, obviously, to your house from the gym. From my gym, literally, I might be able to see it from here. And in between the gym and the car park where I go, anyone who's in Brighton, I go to Cheetah's gym. Best gym in Southeast. Just for me, it's one of those places that's very, very raw, right? And I love it. Right? Just brilliant. Anyway, in between, so people in Brighton who are listening, they'll know that there's obviously a gap between the car park and the Cheetah's King Alfred Centre. And there's a bit of a square of grass and partitioned by a wall. There's 3 tents there where people have got... It's a great location, right? Don't get me wrong, but you know, in terms of obviously it's a beautiful views and stuff like that. And if you were a backpacker and just chilling out and stuff like that, and you spend the night under the stars, I'm sure it'd be lovely. But these people that actually live there. They live there in a tent, and it's just fucked up, man. It's just I walk past.
It's not good enough, is it?
It's fucking horrible. You walk past, you walk, and you just think. And I'm like, you know, you might be having a bad day sometimes, and you look over and you go, "Shit, man." And I don't want to feel. You don't want to like belittle anybody, but you just you wish that. I would wish that those people, maybe they want, and maybe I don't know what that situation is, right? But I'm assuming they probably don't want to be in that situation. I would love for those people to be able to have a roof over their head and be able to look out and have the same, you know, beautiful view. Because you can see the contrast of the picture I'm trying to build is you've got a lovely view of the sea. The same view, but completely different circumstances. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
And it's, sorry to swear, but it's really fucked up.
And do you know what I would wish? I totally agree with you that every human being should have the basic...
Right, of having a house.
Exactly. And I agree. You're putting words in my mouth and they're perfect. So, but, you know, I also look at that and I think, you know, when people think about things like, would I like to pay less tax?
Mm.
Or more importantly, how is my tax being distributed?
Yeah.
And who will I vote for in terms of how they're distributing it?
Yeah.
I hope they think about that because there is a direct relationship.
Yeah, there's definitely a direct relationship. I think... There's got to be more done just generally by government. And I do feel as though that we've been living with a lot less recently, especially since times of austerity. And
what is austerity for those who
austerity is essentially, you know, taking away public spending goes down. I would say does taxation go up? Did taxation go up? No, not really, actually, not under the Tory government. Taxation actually went down and the personal allowance went up. But what happened, there was pay freezes for public sector workers, and yet people who were wealthy got a tax cut. Weird. Corporations got a tax cut. Weird. But that's what happened. So austerity is essentially where, you know, there's not much public spending, there's no money, and we're trying to get the national debt down, right? And it's a book by Mark.
Is the national debt going down?
Apparently, it's gone down. Yeah, but okay. I'm not an economist, but I would say that it has gone down. You know, now the Tories are saying there's no, you know, we have austerity's over. But it's I haven't actually read the book yet, so I'm saying a really good book. I was listening to a, can't remember who it was, but talking as a podcast or a YouTube video, and a book called Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea by an academic called Mark Blyth, I'm pretty sure.
Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea.
Idea or something like that. And it's, I bought it and I've not read it yet. So I'm going to read it. It's just talking about how austerity austerity is not the right way to get yourself through a financial crisis or something like that. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, maybe I'll talk to you about it next time, but it'll be interesting to read that and see how that goes.
Because it doesn't seem that cutting back on public service spending is helping anybody.
Yeah, I think, but I
do see the other side of the coin also, that bloated public spending and public organisations that are not functioning well.
So let's
pick on the NHS again, the National Health Service.
Don't pick on it. We love it. Go on.
So do I. And I love the people who work in it. And I come from a family that's had healthcare workers in New Zealand, so I get it. But what I'm saying is, talk about it fundamentally. It's one of England's largest organisations.
Huge, yeah.
And it's really hard to organise a large number of people, right? It becomes difficult to administer, right?
Yeah.
So it needs some kind of continual evolution and checks and balances and better ways of doing things.
Yeah.
I don't think cutting money off the service is the way to do it.
No.
But I do think that it does deserve the attention and the thought of how can we deliver this better. Should we have big hospitals or should we have lots of smaller hospitals? Small things, but big impact.
Yeah, I think so.
Things that should be investigated.
It's also looking at the roles of what people actually do in these organisations as well. You know, are there quite a few people who are at management level? What do they actually do at these levels?
Mm.
You know, I think fundamentally what you want is more nurses, more doctors, you know what I mean, more healthcare work professionals just generally, and healthcare workers. More people who are on the ground able to help, and they've got that money to really improve and identify things. And I think things like waiting time targets, or maybe when you go to your GP, so in England, when you go to a GP, you have about 10 minutes. They have a waiting time. You have an appointment time of around 10 minutes. And they've got to hit that target for GP waiting times. And putting in those targets, it's like sales targets, isn't it? Like, you end up, you don't get the best.
What happens if you're there with grandma who happens to be Russian and needs a translator?
No, obviously, they do the best they can, but the point is
the metric's not right.
Yeah, correct. And you're measuring it by the wrong metrics, in my opinion, and I think just generally. But then again, I would also then defend the NHS by saying that I tore my Achilles tendon, fully tore off, and bad. You know, really, really bad. I required surgery, was picked up by an ambulance, had a surgeon who was great.
Did you pay for that ambulance?
Just about to say that. No, didn't pay for the ambulance, right? I work, so I pay my taxes.
And that's very different to Australia and America, where you would have to pay for the ambulance.
Didn't have to
pay. In Australia, you have ambulance insurance.
Really?
That you have to pay.
I know in America you have it. I didn't know that in Australia.
Yeah. Oh, sorry,
really?
Keep going.
No, really, did you have that?
I really had it, yeah.
Oh, that's crazy.
And I know people who spent thousands because they didn't have it.
Really?
Some would consider it a basic need of a health service, right? But it was just a privatised thing.
What the fuck is going on? Like, for me,
that's not a good idea,
no,
right?
No, like, you know, charge what? Like, anyway, oh, yeah. Did not have to pay for the ambulance, did not have to pay for the fantastic healthcare that I got. And I remember the name of the paramedic, the guy was named Rod. I was high on laughing gas. Like, they gave me the nitrous oxide. It was brilliant. I thought it was not laughing gas, but it was amazing.
You had a pretty major injury, so fair play.
Yeah. So he gave me that, and I remember just apparently I think I just talked shit to him, like I'm doing now to you. But I'm sober. But the point is it was fantastic from start to finish. It was great, and I got my surgery. Not that long after the injury, was given a cast, they did the tests on me, ultrasound, all the lot, and it was serious injury, so they saw me straight away. There was not much waiting, and I was seen. And I paid nothing for that. Nothing. And, okay, I pay my taxes.
I know personally of a couple that are quite well-heeled Americans, and he's quite a senior sales executive, and you would consider them to be sort of middle class, upper middle class, maybe, by English standards. And he was between jobs, and the health insurance plan of his new job hadn't kicked in because he hadn't started that new contract.
Okay.
Wife pregnant, she goes into a clinic because she had a turn. Nothing was wrong, but they had some tests done in one afternoon, and that cost £15,000.
It's ridiculous.
And they literally had to lift that money out of mum's account and put it into the medical center's account. So what a contrast.
That's amazing. Like, it's
which country is actually doing it better?
It's just like, healthcare should be a basic human right. Like, I think we all agree with this, right? It should be a basic human right. You should not have to go in. So we've got friends in Alaska once again, you know, and we've got a story of like, where there was, I think, around about $60,000 for an appendicitis like, surgery. Like,
I've got an uncle that was in Carolina and had a couple of $100,000. For appendicitis,
like,
I think it was.
And you're thinking to yourself, like, I get the fact that it costs, like, things cost money, right?
And if you have insurance like he did, it's okay, but it's still not okay.
It's not okay.
Why does it cost that much?
Like, the way I see it, I don't get it. Like, for me, I think just generally, healthcare is a human right, and yes, people should pay for that through their taxation, right? And as a result of that, that's why, go back to the same subject, really, that's why tax is a good thing, right? It's great, because I know that if anything was to happen to me, I would be able to go straight to the hospital and I know that I wouldn't be in debt afterwards, right? And that's amazing. Whereas in other jurisdictions, other countries, whatever you want to turn the phrase, that is not the reality.
They call it health poverty, don't they?
But then you hear arguments of saying, well, that's socialism. Yeah, I'm happy with that, though. I'm happy with that.
If socialism in that case is that everybody has these basic rights catered for, then that's good.
Right? I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
I think just generally, you know, it's... So you made a really... You painted a very good picture earlier in the kind of discussion about, I suppose, the levels of poverty, the kind of levels of, you know, opportunity in the UK and what it's actually like and... I think there's a lot of really good stuff about it, and NHS and healthcare being one of them. Okay, it's not perfect, but it's much better than other places.
Mm.
And there is a lot of stuff that is not great.
Sure.
You know, a lot of
stuff. But it's a miracle that it is where it is. And talking to anybody that's in the healthcare service, regardless of whether it's speech and language therapy in schools or whether it's nurses or whether it's physios out in clinics, the stresses that those people are under and the small amount that they get paid compared to a lot of people on the tube in London, 9 o'clock on a Monday morning or 8 o'clock on a Monday morning, it doesn't seem like it's the right balance.
There is a book, I think it's called Bullshit Jobs. I haven't read it, so I can't recommend it, but there's a chart in one of these books anyway that indicates the, the level of money compared to the actual value that job has for society, right? And I think, like, so let's say, I've not read it, but it was described to me as 100 to 1, right? So one would be, like, people who are the most value to society but the lowest paid compared to 100 who are the highest paid who have got no value to society.
Or perhaps negative value.
Yeah, negative value, exactly. And I think, like, a number in the kind of high regions of people, like nursery school teachers, people who really, like, you know, do something good.
I heard about this in The Guardian.
Yeah, yeah. It was in The Guardian, yeah, right? Yeah. So, like, you know, or you would say, like, nurses or whatever, you know. Mm. And I think tax...
People that are literally looking after our children.
Yeah. You know, people
are important.
People are doing, like, some proper good work for society, not the highest pay. I think tax lawyers were, like, up for it. Yeah. Up at the not much value to society.
I'd like to think that you're one of the good guys there. So, let's close that book, pun intended, and let's move on to what's happened since the Achilles, because you've had quite an interesting health journey.
Oh shit! Yeah,
and that's a nice little example of the English language that I say Achilles, because Kiwis always put the emphasis on the first syllable, and you're like, "What do you mean, Achilles?" Which sounds like something.
You really confused me there. what would you like me to discuss?
So since your Achilles went, you were basically stationary, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
stationary, and put on shitloads of weight. Like, put shitloads out. So I'm not a small guy anyway. I'm an ex-rugby player. Played rugby and American football, university and younger. I played for Scotland, played rugby league for Scotland. Went to a World Cup when I was in my teens. Played against countries like Russia and France. And did we play France?
Come on to the health journey then, what's it like to be playing at that level as a kid, basically?
I wouldn't say it was that high level, but I'm maybe just being typical Scottish, like, and pessimistic and not really
just playing it down.
It was a great experience to go. You know, like put it this way, the group of lads that went, you know, none of us, not a lot of them, would have been able to travel to somewhere like Russia, put it that way, including myself, right? It was never a trip that we would have ever been able to do. Amazing experience. I'll never forget it. I've still got like my medal. I've got my you know, instructions, the little book of instructions, the tour instructions, the little band, what do you call those things on your wrist? Rubber band that we had for the tour and all that stuff, my pass to the stadium and stuff like that. It was awesome. Brilliant experience. It's something that, you know, when hopefully I have children, I'd love them to get involved in sport just for the experience. And you don't know, not even to get to that area, you don't have to get to that level. And
so what are the key things for you in sport that are so positive?
It was awesome just generally getting out of the house. You know, my when I was playing sport, because I don't suffer with depression. I hate using that terminology because it's not right. I, you know, have or had depression, you know, and it's just something that's part of my life, really. I you know, dip in and out of.
I think we're getting to the stage where the majority of people have experienced depression.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I think that's well understood by folks.
I no longer take medication per se for it, but, you know, take herbal like medication and I do a lot of exercise and, you know, and I just try and get through it basically that way. But generally the point is that my mental well-being, you know, when I was running around the field and had a real purpose, it's not to say that was part of depression, but generally just had a purpose and I was part of a team, and it was just, I got to meet different people and got to have a bit of confidence about myself, and I enjoyed the competitive nature of it. I loved hitting people. I just loved hitting people, playing rugby league and union as well. I used to love it. Like, it's just, I love the physicality of it. The kind of
which is, and I'm smiling because you're one of the most calm and sort of unassuming big guys that you could meet.
Yeah, put me on a field and I turn into somebody completely different. Like I just turn into
a running brick wall.
I just love, and I don't want to ever cause anybody harm. It's not that. It's just, I just love the physicality, the physical nature of it.
And I get that from surfing, you know. Yeah. I shout at the waves, I throw myself at the waves, then I come up smiling, right?
I would love to surf, but I definitely don't have the ability, I don't have the coordination to do so.
And perhaps not the natural resources to surf easily as well, I would say.
No, but I mean, it would still be fun. But generally, like,
So sport was a good thing for you?
For me, it was a great thing, and I know for other people, maybe they didn't enjoy it. And I think sometimes it's down to experience and the type of people that you're with, and the pressure maybe that you maybe perceive yourself to be under, or that you are.
Did you get that
under
pressure from your parents?
No, never had any pressure. Never had any pressure. I just did it. I was decent, and I went, I was like, fuck it, I'll try that. And got in, you went, played through school. Like, we didn't have, football was a sport in our school.
And it's quite fascinating that football is
shit in Scotland.
Yeah.
So bad.
But isn't rugby reasonably posh?
So rugby league, actually, if you compare the two, so rugby league in the UK isn't posh.
True.
So you would call it, you know,
but rugby itself,
air quote, yeah, rugby would be perceived to be a posh sport, and I can see why, because there is a lot of fee-paying schools that would, you that would.
And when you say fee-paying, you mean effectively a private school.
Private school, yeah. So I think it's down here it's different. Public school, private school, I don't get it. Yeah, fee-paying school. You play rugby, you know, and it's all like rah rah, you know.
But rugby league.
But you play both, and you can play both in public private school. Sorry, but I think rugby league is more of a north of England sport. Mm. Like you're, and this is no slight to anybody from there, but it's like your Warringtons, your Wigan, Leeds, Bradford, and the industrial, hardworking, really great places, but you know what you would call it is you wouldn't perceive, you say posh to somebody in England, you probably wouldn't say those areas. Not to say that they're beautiful. You've got places like Harrogate near Leeds, which
I take your point, and I guess
it's a perception thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm probably not using it correctly for the UK, but for folks outside of the UK, perhaps we should just replace that word with wealthy.
Yeah, no, I get that.
And going to a private school.
And, you know, the rugby club where I played, because I played rugby union as well for Hamilton, and, you know, with some really nice cars in the car park, the rugby club atmosphere, you know, and you did have, you know, people who were from the scheme around the corner playing, and people who lived in really nice big houses, you know, and it was a kind of, that was what it was, but it was...
And when did you stop?
So I broke my ankle playing rugby league. and I was still involved with the Scotland kind of rugby league scene. Broke my ankle playing club rugby league, and it was off season for rugby union, so I was just like, right, and I broke my ankle and stopped. And then I got into American football because a group of friends from school were playing American football, and I just got into that. So then I played American football since the age of like 17 all the way throughout uni, and then stopped because I played in London, played in East Kilbride, and then I played in, I played all over the country though, rugby league, rugby league, American football. I was like, uni has made captain American football team, which isn't a big deal, but it was quite cool, like, to be designated a leader in that respect.
So that basically means, if we take it back to the Achilles now,
I was active.
It means that you not only were you active, but you were active in an organised way, right? You were training for something.
Yeah.
You had people, I imagine, in the gyms who were for the team who were saying, this is how you train.
Yeah. And I was,
eat this, don't eat that.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I would say that. I think, I got to a point where I was, when I started uni especially, I was I had a six pack, I was lean, and I was very, I was training 6 days a week, playing a game in the seventh. I just had the energy, but I'm young at that point. And I would say that, I put weight on when I came down to England because I didn't have this. So I moved down to Kent and just didn't have the same kind of infrastructure around me.
Mm.
So I wasn't as active, but I still kept, I was at a good weight, didn't have any issues. Did my Achilles tendon and all of a sudden ballooned up to... I can't remember the exact weight, but I ballooned up by about 2-3 stone, maybe a bit more, I'd say.
And in kilos, that's
fucking shitloads. A lot.
And obviously, didn't feel good, right?
No, to be honest, I didn't feel good, but I didn't notice it. It's kind of because I'm a big guy anyway. I lift weights. I'm a power lifter as well, Olympic weight lifter. So being heavy isn't a bad thing in these areas, but it's kind of like, When you're not doing that, you're carrying timber.
What I mean is that you didn't feel good because you had to stop doing things that are part of your...
Didn't feel great at
part
all.
...of your regime, right?
Yeah, exactly, and I wouldn't just generally... So anyway, point is that I've gradually been losing weight. I just got to a point where it's like, shit, where have I got to? And I've been training again and things like that. And, the thing is life gets in the way as well because
you work a lot.
Yeah, I do, yeah. And working in London and commuting in and out is difficult. And there's a gym in work, but it's shit. And to honestly, I don't always get a lunch break. Just to qualify there, it's not because people don't tell me to take a lunch break. I'm just that type of person where I'll just work through.
Me too. I've worked in places where people would say, bring your dog in, work from home when you need to, all these sorts of things. And I would still work through my lunch break if there was something I wanted to get done.
And where I work, exactly the same thing. I won't bring my dog to work, but where I work, it's work from home, flexible working, all that kind of stuff. Make sure that and really big push on your mental health and making sure that you feel valued and all that stuff. So where I work is fantastic, right? But it's the nature of the beast. I feel responsible for the work that I do. So therefore, which I should do because I'm an adult. Therefore, what I do is I just work. And I'll get in at 8-ish. And I'll work through till 6. And I'll just do that. And there is no issue. But that has its issues because obviously you get home, you're knackered. But I'll make sure that I'll go to the gym 3 days a week and I'll lift weights. I do.
So let's talk about how you've dropped the weight and got to where you are now.
That's the next point. So yeah, I started fasting. I'm doing intermittent fasting.
So what does that mean?
So essentially it means I'll abstain from eating breakfast and lunch sometimes, and I'll go from dinner to dinner, which is an extreme, right? And if you ever want to do fasting, I'd probably take it slow, but I've been doing this for quite a while now.
So when you say take it slow,
maybe
do some reading.
Do 16 hours. Make sure that you're able to do so. Don't be dumb. Drink shitloads of water. If you want to have a coffee, do that. Just don't eat food, right? Just anything that would be conceived as a calorie, just don't have it. And just do it for maybe 12 hours.
Which basically means you just might miss breakfast. One day a week
or
something like that, right?
8 till 12 or whatever. You know what I mean? Just do it that way.
And what did you find when you first started fasting? How does that help?
My mental... This is going to sound... Oh, your mental health. My mental clarity.
This is a safe place, right? People are listening because they want to learn.
Yeah. So, but my mental clarity has gone... It's just so much better. I don't get that afternoon lull. I don't get that afternoon depression. Not a good word to use. That afternoon tiredness. I suppose it's depression of my energy levels, I suppose. And I'm focused and I'm switched on. I'm really switched on. And I have people who don't understand fasting, like, that can't be good for you. Like,
while they're having their fifth coffee and a chocolate bar, right?
Exactly.
At three in the afternoon.
And a lot of people, I can't do without food. And they're not fat people. Like, they're just... But in my opinion, it's not about fat. And being fat, obviously, is bad for you, right? It just is. Because I carry timber, all right? So I'm not going to, I'm not some model here. But I would say that excess weight is not good for you. Simple, right? Puts a lot of strain in your heart and everything else. But the point is, you can also be skinny fat. Right, you can be people who don't do exercise.
Seriously, would say fat on the inside.
Yeah, no,
or the skinny fat man.
Yeah, no, but it's true. People do it. People who don't exercise and who don't have, all that kind of stuff, who will tell you, that's not good for you. And I'm like, look, you do you and I'll do what I do. And I'm not by any stretch of the imagination the epitome of health, but at the same time, I've got a good heart rate. My heart is, I've got one of those Apple Watches. I measure my heart rate quite regularly. I do a lot of running now. And it's my heart rate goes down, my weight's gone down, and my mental clarity's gone up, right? And it's not just fasting. Fasting is essentially abstaining from calories. I think the important thing is here is calories are key. You have to calories.
Explain that.
And what I mean by that is what you eat and the expenditure is really important, right? It just is.
Because calories effectively are energy.
Exactly.
Is that right?
So I've done things like the ketogenic diet where it's like high fat, low carbohydrate. I've done low carbohydrate. I've done paleo. I've done...
Me too. Yeah.
No, and you know what? I do feel great in these things. And you do go up and down and whatever else. I think that just generally, and this is speaking from someone who... This is personal to me and it works for me and everyone's very different. My current diet is I'll fast, right? So I'm abstaining from calories and I'll do it from dinner till dinner. Right, it's easy for me. I'll have a lovely dinner and I'll have meat and I'll have vegetables and fruit and whatever and I'll just have a lovely meal, right?
Would you say it's a large meal for a big guy or a normal meal for a big guy or a small?
I would say it's a normal meal.
Okay.
Like it's a normal meal for me and so that could be like a steak for instance and like some vegetables and then like fruit at the end of it and all that stuff, right? It's just what happens. It's quite a lot of food to take in, but it works for me. It's my lifestyle. It fits, right? But the calories, I started tracking my calories. And when I was doing keto, I was like, why am I not losing that much weight? Even though everyone talks about you lose shitloads of weight. You lose a lot of water weight, yeah. But you need to burn enough energy in order for you to lose. You have to be in a caloric deficit to be able to lose weight. It's simple. So I've lost so far, actually, I said to you 10, I've lost more than 10 kilos, actually, if I'm being very truthful here. I've lost around about 15 kilos in total from the period of actually starting to where I am now, right? And I'm losing now around about a kilo-ish a week, maybe. And it's recently stalled, because I've been, I've gone out for drinks and done this and done that, with work and all that stuff. But my new normal is a lot lower than what it was, if that makes sense. And I need to leave. I think for me to get back to where I was before my Achilles and when I was at uni, I'd probably need to lose another 7 kilos.
So you would basically go, just visually speaking, from like a rugby player physique or maybe an American football player physique, a big, like quite wide guy, right?
Yeah,
broad-shouldered and big-armed, to effectively what I would imagine is a tall, athletic guy.
I think
quite a big visual difference.
I think for me, for me to get to that point. So when I was 18, I was like, I'm 6'3", I'm quite tall, I've got long arms, long legs and stuff like that. And when I was at my smallest, people said I didn't look right. I looked great physically, but it was like I was really, really skinny.
So you're not trying to get back to that.
And I didn't like that. I quite like being, I like me, right? I like being able to lift weights. I like being able to squat, bench, and deadlift, but I also want to be able to do things like bouldering, and which I do or have done, and just being able to do things that are functionally a bit better. And I think when you
chase the dog and not get tired, right?
Yeah, so I run a lot now. Like I love it, right? And it's just one of the things I've just got back into.
But what sort of shoes have you got?
I've got the what you call it, Brooks. What are they called? The Ghost something. They're really good. They're really, really good. Yeah, they cost me decent amount of money, but like they're the best shoes I've ever run, and they're starting to fray a little bit because I've been doing quite a lot of hard miles. But look, put it this way, like I'm on a good journey. But the point is when I talk about calories are the most important thing. And I'm not a fitness expert, right? I'm not a fitness expert. So for people who are maybe listening going, talk shit, you know, you've got to think about wider things, blah, blah, blah. But I think sometimes we overcomplicate stuff. I think when you start for me, like I was doing all the kind of, as I said, keto, this, that, the next thing. And I was really being quite complicated. It was really complex.
And it feels quite strict, right?
Correct. And you're just like, well, I need to make sure that I'm getting my bone broth. I need to make sure I'm putting cream in my coffee. Right, okay.
Or butter in your coffee.
Fucking right.
And like, cooking it well.
And that'll make me lose. And you just, and fundamentally, I think to myself, like, think about this really logically. What is going to make me lose weight is if I eat less and move more, is how I'll lose weight. Now, given the fact that, and I would say this, the enjoyment I had over the last few years, I would say, about what I've done with my body in terms of, you know, I've always maintained a good shape, right?
You are active, right? Conscious of what you eat.
So, for instance, my shoulders are more narrow than my waist, right? That's, you know, and I lift weights and all that stuff, but I'm going in a good direction that way. So, it's going to take me time, but it's a good journey because I now have found the key to me, which is like, right, eat less, move more. Simple, isn't it? And I don't have to worry about, like, you know, in a meal, I'll have cheese and I'll have maybe some carbohydrates. Whereas before, I'd be like, oh, shit. I need to only eat cheese.
Or I can't eat cheese.
Or I can't eat
diet,
cheese.
Right?
And it's just like, nah. I'm just like, look, what are the calories? Cool. These are my calories for the day. I'm just going to stick to it. Done. And it's just simple. And I think now I'm just like, right, let's not overcomplicate stuff. But at the same time, you know, there's maybe some good reason for people to do things like keto because it does work.
And the other incredible thing is that our bodies change over time, right?
Exactly.
Like my dad used to say, and pat his tummy and say, your time will come, son.
Yeah.
And I was like, whatever, Dad, I'm never going to put weight on. But, you know, here I am, I've turned 40, and I'm still a skinny guy, right?
Yeah, you're right, man.
But there is something where there was nothing.
Right? Yeah, I get that.
And so I realize now that I can't, no, I can do whatever I like, but I don't want to drive back from surfing, eat half a king-sized chocolate bar and have fried chicken.
Nice.
With the dog on each leg, watching movies for the evening. That used to be my Saturday in Melbourne, right? But I was in my late 20s.
Yeah.
Right? These days, I find that my needs are different, and actually what I want is different. And something that I think is really important for people to think about is that to digest food, we have bacteria and enzymes and cultures in our stomach, right? And if I eat lots of chocolate, then sugar-loving bacteria and enzymes grow in my stomach and become a larger part of the population.
Exactly.
And those send a signal through the body to say, feed me. And then I find myself 3 o'clock in the afternoon saying, Ben, why are you fasting? I'm just going to have another chocolate bar. It's not that I want a chocolate bar. That what's happening in my stomach wants a chocolate bar. And what's fascinating is that someone who had at one stage 3 or 4 times a week fried chicken, because I freaking love it. God, I love it so much.
I love it so much too.
But you know what? I haven't had it for quite a while and I don't crave it. Do you know what I crave now? Fatty fish.
Yeah.
Because Hannah, my girlfriend, bless her, she's really into cooking. She's really into food. She loves the Italian-style diet, which, although it does include pasta, like you were saying, also includes way more fish than probably the rest of the world realizes.
Sure.
And now I just crave, salmon. I crave mackerel. I need that oily fish because I've got that bacteria in my stomach that want to digest and eat that food.
And
maybe things can be that simple.
It's like, that, I think because the food that you're talking about, they're quite fatty.
Mm.
So they make you feel full.
Yeah, that's another good point.
It's another point. And I think for me, I don't eat much, any chocolate, especially during the week, no chocolate bar. So like at work, people bring it, I'll eat that. It's just because I just don't want to. Right, I don't want to do my fasting, and it's not because I'm perfect. It's not that I just like doing it.
But there is a massive difference, no doubt you've seen, between you and the people in the office who eat sugar a lot.
Precisely. So they will go and they will eat, and look, there's no judgment here, right? The point is that that's just what it works for them, right? They've got, maybe they do cycling, maybe this, maybe they do that. Point is it just doesn't work for me. I know that I am the type of person that if I start eating, I'll go. fucking balls to the wall, and I'll go straight. I'll go for it, right? I'm just one of those guys, right? It's just how I am, no discipline, okay? But the point I'm making is that I just know that if I abstain from it, I know that it'll be better for me in the long run. It doesn't mean that I can't have fun, though. It doesn't mean that I'm, like, not eating, you know, good food or anything like that. You know, tonight I'm going to go to a party. I'm going to eat some nice food, and I'm going to, you know, have, you know, some dessert, or have this, or have that. But it just means I just do it once in a while. Don't do it every bloody day.
Yeah.
I think for me, though, like, that's how it works. Now, if you look at me, I've got a bit how I think I look and probably what I actually look like. I just kind of always see myself as a big guy, right? That's how I am.
But just so you know, folks, what he's describing is what I'm seeing. It's quite accurate. And that's the Scott in you. And
yeah.
Bless him for making you honest.
No, exactly. Like, I'm just kind of who I am, right? But at the same time, I'm also seeing a lot of changes. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's the point.
And it's okay to explore different things, to be in different spaces. One day you might have kids, and what exercise you do and the time that you have to do exercise changes.
Yeah.
So perhaps you're able to move less, and perhaps you then choose to eat less proportionally
exactly.
to keep that calorific deficit. Right?
Exactly. So like today, like I was in the gym today benching. I haven't eaten. It's now 5 o'clock. I haven't eaten since dinner last night. Like, and
how do you feel? Like, do you feel that hungry feeling in your stomach?
No, not at all. Not hungry. I'm not hungry at all. Like, I've had a coffee. Like, I feel fine.
It's amazing.
I probably, and this is not because of, you know, look at me type thing. I just know I could probably eat. I could probably not eat all night and probably go to the next day. I've done it. I've actually done it in days where I've like fasted for 3 days. Just under 3 days. Like, I've done that. Felt fine. Absolutely fine.
And then, of course, it depends on the body type. It depends on the age,
I've got
lifestyle.
So I've got, like, muscle and fat.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And so you burned that.
And so I burned through, like, the fat and stuff. But the point is that it I was doing an experiment, but felt fine. And it was a weird... And I would like one day to... Maybe I'll come back on your podcast if you're happy back. But I would like to try...
Sounds good.
I'd love to try. Thank you. I'd love to try doing, like, a full... like a 5 day, 7 day fast, because I've heard people talking about it, and it's just more about like the discipline.
It's cleansing, like, right? Because what is it, 40%, 50% of our energy goes into digestion.
Yeah.
And so there's a reason that you're having mental clarity the next morning, because you didn't just have a big bowl of sugary porridge.
There's no blood pulling in my stomach. You know, it's not being diverted from other areas of my body. You know.
Now, I've almost kept you long enough.
I've got phone calls about my wife saying, like, where are you? We need to be going. So
that's fair.
Sorry.
So it's been awesome. So one last question that I ask folks is there something you'd like to ask me?
Yeah. Okay. So I don't know if I want to make it profound or I want to just make it just...
You will be back. You will have another chance to answer this question.
Where do you see yourself? No, not where do you see yourself. That's a fucking interview question. Well, come on, Ben. Think about it. What's your next goal, then? What's the big goal for you? What's the next thing?
What's the next thing?
So the reason I've qualified this, right, people don't know you. So ever since I've met you, you and I have worked together, right? We met at, you know, a place that shall not be named. but we both worked in the same place, hit it off, just got on. And you've always been somebody who's got ideas. You've always been just a personality that you draw to, right? Like, you're just drawn to your type of personality. You're calm, you're cool, right? You know, got a cool ass flat, right? You've got just a good, I don't know, you're always... thinking and innovating and just doing stuff and stuff. So like podcasts, I've always wanted to do a podcast, but just being lazy and never done it, right? You do it, right? So you've always got something going on, and it's always something that, in my opinion, is like the betterment of yourself, maybe of others as well. So what's the next thing? Like, have you thought about that?
It's amazing to hear yourself described by someone else. I appreciate all of that.
Hopefully it's nice.
It is. It's quite humbling, actually. I think the main thing that I'm working on right now is being safe. And I think that's something that comes from having three of my grandparents being born in England and London and growing up and living during World War II and seeing the Blitzkrieg and the bombs are dropping and then they've got rationing and then they move across the world to New Zealand to get a better life. They move in as poor migrants. They're working class. They work really hard. All they want to be is safe. Mm. All they want to have is enough. And so the thing that I'm really learning about right now is the stuff that a lot of my better healed contemporaries when I was at university were already talking about with their parents in terms of getting a house and in terms of being financially secure and having everything in place. So for me, it's having a flat and it's setting up that flat so that I know that I will always have a place to live. And it's setting up my pension so that I know that I will have enough to retire. Mm. And it's learning enough about my pension to realize that the old world of giving my money to a large financial institution who actively manages it with high fees is going to halve the amount of pension that I have. And therefore, maybe there's other ways that I could invest my money using better technology, like, say, an index fund that might produce a better outcome. And the next episode will be on that topic, actually.
That's a good plug. I like that.
That's what, something I'm thinking about, right?
No,
but also it's about being safe and balanced in my health and my well-being. Mm. And so something that I've really noticed coming from New Zealand through Australia to the UK is that the UK, for better or for worse, has less working hours and more holiday. And a healthier approach to the way that people work. Now, people who are listening might say, what are you talking about? You grew up surfing in the country in New Zealand. Yeah, I did. But people commuted up to 2 hours each way and worked really long hours. I did all-nighters in my 20s. Got to Australia and people didn't know what all-nighters were, right? But Australians still work really hard.
Yeah.
When we're talking about people who live in cities who are professionals. So I'm also learning how to be safe physically and emotionally and mentally. And so this podcast is partially the exploration of that and working out things that are simple, that make sense, that work.
Mm.
You know, maybe I don't need to eat as much meat as I used to. So I'm exploring that at the moment and I'll have someone on to talk about that specifically. But in the last few days, I've really just had soups and a couple of fry-ups. And some of those soups have been meat soups. Most of them have been vegetable. I've been drawing on what I've been learning from places like Portugal and Spain and Italy, and I've been adding more beans and legumes and things like tins of lentils to my soup to see what happens. And the amazing thing is it keeps me full and I'm not hungry straight away and I haven't put a piece of steak on that. So I'm learning about that as well. So that's the thing that I'm focusing on at the moment.
It's interesting. Yeah, I think safety. It's an interesting topic, and I think you've packed in quite a lot there. You know, financial security, your well-being being huge, and I didn't expect anything less from a well-being point of view. And I don't, you know, I'm not trying to butter you up here, but you've always been quite unaware of that kind of stuff. And I think that kind of attitude is important. I think just to make sure that you are safe physically, mentally, ready to kind of deal with whatever life throws at you, if that makes sense.
Particularly when a lot of people have, people like me, have workaholic tendencies.
Mm.
And so it's really important to recognize in myself when I need to stop and be safe.
I am.
You know?
I can't agree anymore about that. You know, I was talking to you about my week this week. You know, it's just one of those ones where you're just like, what the hell, you know? And you just, it's a blur.
Glad to get to the end in one piece, right?
It's a blur. But it's like you put that pressure on yourself. And it's not, you know, it just is where it is. But
sure.
that safety or that clarity, the clarity that allows you to get to the point of trying to find safety is really important. You have to sometimes go through the mist before you get to.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
But yeah, no, it's a good answer as always. Yeah.
And speaking of knowing when to stop, thank you for tuning in, folks. You know how to subscribe. We're now on Apple iTunes or what's now known as Apple Podcasts, on Spotify and on Google Podcasts or wherever else you find them. So thanks for tuning in. And Ben, thank you for being a guest.
Yeah, thanks. Once again, this is what, number 3?
Yeah, I think it might be.
Number 3. Might be. I'm getting used to this, but yeah, really cool. Thanks for the experience. It's really awesome.
You're welcome. All right, folks, tune in next time.